Linux Format Magazine is 150 issues old. Congratulations, everybody.
Well done. Well done, Mike. Been here from the beginning.
Happy birthday, Mike.
Yep, I've been here since issue one, albeit as a freelancer, until issue 70 when I came to destroy your lives. a lot has happened in those 150 issues.
Yeah, it has.
Can you remember what happened when you joined? What was that about issue 70, Graham?
It was about, I can't remember exactly. It was about 60 or 62,
oh, right.
61, sometime around then, and it was just Paul and Nick in the central desk surrounded by accounts people in a different building without any windows. It was very dark. Didn't even have a computer.
Is that how you expected Linux Format would
no,
be?
No, I when I first came, I thought, oh, all these people are working for Linux Format. You know, a room with 100 people in, you know, there's the news desk over there. there's the review centre.
The labs.
The publishers are having a meeting over there in the boardroom about next issue, but no, it was just the three of us.
Awesome, brilliant. Okay, well, let's get on to this podcast. This is Season 3, Episode 18 of the Tux Radar Podcast. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Jennifer Roberts.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Efrain Hernandez.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
Brilliant. And in this episode, we'll be talking about Ubuntu's possible new release schedule. We've got our discoveries, the brilliant You Dare Us challenge that I'm sure we've completed with great success. Speak Your Brains, where you get the chance to say something, listeners, and of course, the open ballot. When you've thoroughly digested this podcast and you love it, then you can take out a subscription to the aforementioned Linux Format magazine and keep us going for another 150 issues. You can subscribe and get all the goodness of the magazine at tuxradar.com/subscribe. So let's get straight into the news. Scott Remnant, who might be on the Ubuntu technical board or might not be now, I'm not sure.
Did he used to be?
He used to be, yeah. I think he used to be like the release manager or something for Ubuntu.
So, yeah.
But he has put up an interesting blog post proposing monthly releases for the Ubuntu distribution as opposed to the six-month cycle that they've got at the moment. What do you make of that?
I think it's mad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's mad too.
Madness. The whole point of the thing that made Ubuntu cool was take Debian but give it a reliable six-monthly release cycle.
Yeah.
And if they've, you know, if they've found that they've had to rush software forward to get it included in the six-monthly releases, then that's not a problem with the release cycle. That's a problem with their attitude.
Mm.
And changing the release cycle won't alter that.
I mean, from my point of view, having used Arch now for probably 8 months or something and found it to be probably more stable than any Ubuntu or Fedora release I've ever used, I kind of see the whole release cycle thing full stop as just a mad idea. So counterintuitive for desktop users, and perhaps enterprise users have a rolling release that you branch every 3 years and give, you know, 5 years security support to that release.
Yeah.
But the rolling release model works so excellently for desktop users. You know, Firefox is out one day and it's in the repositories the next. GNOME Shell was out 1 week and it was in the repositories the next week. And just that's an incredible turnaround time.
I think you're absolutely right. And I also think that it could be Linux's killer feature because it's something that neither Windows nor OS 10 can compete with.
You never update it and you never buy a new one and you always
have the latest version.
And it's always secure. You don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
Packages can be signed so you know you're getting them from a reliable source.
Yeah, but isn't the problem that you end up having to upgrade things if you don't like them or not? Yeah, I know you can pin packages back to not get them, but you end up, great, so you can get new software when it's released, but then you've got to get the new GNOME here and the new kernel, which might break compatibility in a piece of hardware. And
that might be a problem with a hobbyist OS like Arch, but for someone like Fedora to switch to a rolling release and get branched enterprise Linux releases every 3 or 4 years or whatever, at least you're going to get to use the old name for 5 years. But even in that situation, unless the old name keeps getting developed, you're going to have to upgrade or change at some point anyway.
You are. I'm just thinking, what if we look at what consumers really want, if you look how much trouble Microsoft had getting people to move from XP onwards.
Yeah.
Okay, Vista had its problems, but people were settled on XP. They just wanted a platform that worked for them, and they'd set it up and they'd install their stuff. They wanted to get the newest apps. They didn't want something that was constantly changing under their feet all the time.
Yeah, it's an important point. It's the same point that we've discussed in terms of Firefox. It'd be interesting if we had streams, so you could have you could subscribe to a stream when you install something like Arch. You could subscribe to the security updates, or you could subscribe to the desktop updates or the minor version number updates.
Yeah.
updates. You know, so you actually have some choice.
Which is more or less, I guess, Debian stable testing and experimental.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It is a model that I think needs to be explored and tested. Yeah. And I'd love to see it picked up by a major distribution like Ubuntu or Fedora and given a go. I really think it could work. And OpenSUSE, in fact, with their Tumbleweed service, are looking at doing something similar.
I'd like to see a distro where the desktop applications are rolling, but the platform itself is stable. So, you know, well, in the Linux world, we haven't decoupled applications from the OS. It's all one big churn and it's always moving. But if we could have something, if you look at the way iOS works, where you get one major release a year, say, but you can get new applications whenever the developers release them,
you don't have to update your distro.
Yeah. So you've got a stable platform, say, okay, this is how it's going to be for a year. But, oh, there's a new Angry Birds out, there's a new word processor. Rolling release would be brilliant for applications when they just come out and appear. But you know your kernel won't suddenly change, or your X server, or config files, or anything like that.
I mean, there's questions around it, but I mean, a rolling release makes so much more sense than a monthly release.
Yeah.
And
if you want a monthly release with Ubuntu, you can easily, you know, grab on the alphas or the release candidates, and then you're updatable and they're quite easy to use.
So, and also the other thing with Arch is the whole, you know, the fact that philosophy of when it's ready, when Upstream says it's stable and not patching what Upstream does, because Upstream gives it so much more testing and it uses so used by so many more people. It makes sense to me.
Meanwhile, Bruce Perrins has suggested a new scheme for copyright assignment, because there's always been this perennial problem in free software, hasn't there, that you might want to contribute to a free software project, but that project demands that you hand over the copyrights of the code as well so they can relicense it later on.
Yeah, Sun used to do that, didn't they?
Yes.
Canonical want to do that I'm not sure which.
Yeah, Canonical want to do that, don't they? Well, Mark Shuttleworth suggested it recently.
That's one of the reasons why Open Solaris didn't take off.
Oh, right, because of the copyright thing.
Yeah, the licensing thing that's not as good as the GPL.
CFDL. Is it a CFDL?
CDDL?
Oh, community something license.
You can work on it, but hey, we own it.
Yeah. So Bruce Perrins has come up with an idea. He says a company can covenant to each contributor of a copyright to continue to support and maintain a project as open source for a fixed period after a particular contribution, or to remove the contribution from their product if they cannot continue to open source their work. So you hand over a bit of code to them and the copyright, but they've got to keep it open source for 3 years, I think he said. Is that about right?
Yeah, something like that, I think, was what he proposed.
Mm.
That's better than nothing, but I'd rather people just live with free software.
In practical terms, how do you remove, say, a line of code from a system kernel when it's been built on and rewritten and built on and patched and fixed however many times since you submitted it originally?
It's a lot of work, but it does happen. I mean, it's part of the reason why Java took so long to be released under a genuinely free license.
Oh.
It's because Sun had to go, when they decided to do it, they had to go back through every line of source code and actually work out where it had come from, who owned it, and whether they had to replace it with something else.
Yeah, this people have said, you know, before, oh, wouldn't it be great if IBM open sourced OS2, for instance? And who knows, maybe IBM would actually quite like to do that, but they've got no chance, because there's code in there from loads of different companies. There's code in there from Microsoft, so.
The interesting thing about the whole copyright assignment thing is that the Free Software Foundation actually demands copyright assignment for any contributions to the GNU project.
Mm.
But reading on the Linux Weekly News, and I can't guarantee this, the Free Software Foundation signed a contract saying it will stay free forever. Whereas the difference with Mark Shuttleworth and what Bruce Perrins wants to do is that at least Mark Shuttleworth has explicitly stated that having the option to relicense under a proprietary license leads to greater investment in a company. And that's one of the major reasons he wants copyright assignment. So there's Bruce Perrins seems to be somewhere in the middle here, guaranteeing at least some open source.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's kind of a spectrum of why people want to do it with regard to protecting the free software ecosystem.
Yeah, it's like the good old free software versus open source argument, isn't it? Free software is all about the principles behind it, whereas open source is more about the practicalities.
It's interesting that often the principles of free software seem to align with the practicalities so strongly.
Mm.
And you know, it's the principles of free software that laid the foundations for open source and set it up to be what it is and so successful in business, you know. It is free software still, it's just the way you pitch it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, why compromise that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've actually got an extra bit of news.
Oh no!
It's from Jamie Dillion from Child's Play. This is the charity that is the one of the beneficiaries of the Humble Indie Bumble.
Oh, cool!
Humble Indie. You said it.
This we report on this issue in LXF 150, which should be in shops literally within hours. They've finished their latest Humble Indie Bumble. They've finished their latest offer of games, and Linux users, of course, pay a lot more than Mac or Windows users, and therefore make a larger contribution to charity. So I got in contact with Child's Play and asked them for some of their words, and here's what we got back. The Humble Bundle has been an incredible source of support. The money raised provides consoles and games for our network of over 60 hospitals across the US and the world. Being in the hospital as a child can be scary and certainly uncomfortable. The ability to play a DS game during dialysis or a multiplayer game with family members can help kids feel a sense of normality and provide a distraction from the less pleasant aspects of being hospitalised. The Humble Bundle, along with many other fundraisers, gives us the ability to provide those benefits to thousands of families yearly. So,
brilliant.
Awesome.
Really cool.
Excellent. That's
work,
wonderful.
Everybody.
Yeah.
I like the idea of these kids in hospital playing things like Resident Evil.
Or what's that surgery one? Okay, is it time for Discovery of the Week?
Well, it's your favourite section, isn't it?
I've discovered very little in my discovery. I'll get it out of the way.
Yeah,
because I haven't had a chance. But I've been playing with the user repository, Arch's user repository of packages, and it's awesome. And the whole package format, I think, is brilliant. But specifically, I downloaded Crossover Office for the first time in ages. And there's Crossover Office packages in the AUR.
I thought that was a proprietary...
Yeah, it is. And this is what
where's it then?
No. I've got a real license for it.
Oh, okay.
But if you've I have.
I believe you.
It actually defaults to a 30-day trial if you don't have that anyway. So it's not so bad. But I just love the way that a single package container can do stuff like proprietary software like Crossover Office and download it in exactly the same way as whatever AAA, the Hot Pick game that I installed the other day, which downloads the source code from SourceForge and compiles it and installs it in exactly the same package container. And I just think it's incredible. I think AUR packages and the archives and Pac-Man in general is brilliant, and it's simple.
Yeah,
It's just a simple script.
I'm getting convinced here, and I think I'm going to buy a new laptop in a month or so. So when I do, I'm going to put Arch Linux on it. That's right. I'm going to give it a go at least. Yeah. If it's too much hassle, I might.
But you can just open up the package build scripts that ties all of this disparate functionality together, and you can see that it's wgetting the binaries from the Crossover Office site, and see the MD5 sums that it's checking in. It's no weird like a Debian package or something like that, which requires, a sacrifice. Yeah.
CPIO.
Yeah. It's so cool.
It's really awesome because the packages that come out of the AUR then get put through Pac-Man, which is the normal package installer. So if you want to remove something, you don't have to make uninstall or whatever. And you don't have to search through your file system for all the files that were owned by that package. Just Pac-Man RS and it's all gone. And
if you install something like Packer or the one of the GUIs for this, you can update all AUR packages at the same time.
Yeah, and it just downloads and rebuilds them. And so it is
a discovery because it just reminded it how brilliant it is and what a brilliantly simple solution it is to a problem that really should be solved by now.
Excellent.
Cool. Well, I've got a great discovery.
You always do.
The original name for Kellogg's was the Battle Creek Toasted Cornflake Company, which I think is great.
What? So
cool. What a great name, Battle Creek. If only they could put that on their products now.
That is awesome.
And that's it, John.
My discovery was that Apple, apparently there was a game in the App Store which walked someone through the manufacture of a smartphone, and it focused on some of the less pleasant aspects to show the reality of smartphone manufacture and our consumer electronics. So it started off mining for the resources in some lithium mine in China. Then it progresses through to the factory where you've got to save workers from committing suicide before you end up at a dump where you have to catch them. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't played it, but and then it ends up in a landfill site somewhere with all the e-waste and the, you know, chemicals seeping out into the groundwater and stuff like that. But anyway, slightly it sounds a great game, but slightly concerningly, Apple have removed it from the App Store, which just goes to show the problem with a company having control over what goes into a product like that. And if Apple ever got a monopoly situation on apps and the App Store and information sharing, it would be terrifying. So there's strong reason there to actually care about these kind of issues.
I have a lot of respect for Apple, but if there's one thing Apple doesn't have, it's a sense of humour.
Yeah, or even, you know, they're just malicious, you know, they just want to protect that. I shouldn't say that, I'll get done for.
You'll get done in.
Two shots, back of the head.
That's how Apple does things.
But, you know,
we're not implying that.
So they're not malicious then?
The thing I don't like is that, you know, they'll do whatever they can to protect their business image and to protect their general interests. And it doesn't really, they don't care if it supports free speech or if it, you know, does away with satire and all kinds of useful things that are important to a democracy.
Yeah.
So something to be concerned about and reasons why we should all care about whether or not companies get monopolies.
And stop buying Apple products.
Yeah. Why do people do it?
I don't know.
Derek, hand me over.
My discovery is that Abbey Word is better than InDesign.
Wow.
Whoa.
I know, it's awesome, isn't it?
So we can make the magazine an Abbey Word.
Well, hold your steady.
Sorry, Andrew. Sorry.
Every fortnight, I copy and paste the comments from Open Ballot into InDesign. And then I have to go through it again to separate things out, because it adds all sorts of silly spaces, and I mark up, you know, interesting and pertinent and downright silly comments and things that people have said. Today, because I was doing it at home, watching Scotland very narrowly beat Georgia, I did it in Abbey Word, and Abbey Word recognised all the headings and the paragraphs automatically.
That's cool.
Abbey Word in better than InDesign shock.
I do like Abbey Word.
There we go. I do.
It hasn't been updated for a while, has it? I don't think. I don't know if they're working on 3.0 or something.
I don't know why anyone would use OpenOffice, LibreOffice. It's just so good. It's so fast, and it does everything I want it to do, and I don't want it to do anything more.
I think Open LibreOffice have more features in terms of like layout and stuff, but if you're going to use layout, use Scribus as just for processing words like a word processor is supposed to. Abbey Word kicks ass.
Exactly. Two other minor discoveries. In predictive, the language of predictive text, Scots is also pants.
Is there meaning behind that?
Je ne sais pas. And the third discovery of the week is that the Greek public transport system is Scots.
Okay.
In Greek.
And pants.
I got two. The first one is a discovery, but it's also a complaint. And recently I moved home and I...
Did you? You could have told us.
Was it already set up and ready to go when you moved in?
was pretty much... done.
With the exception of
a few things to do. Anyway, I was left without a telephone line on this new house. Anyway, so I decided to use Skype as a main telephone line, and it works right on my computer. If you're calling from a landline or you're calling a landline, using Skype, it works right. But if you're using it on your smartphone, it only works okay if you call in another Skype subscriber.
And you've got an Android phone.
Yes. And I thought, well, I'm not going to put the computer on today. I'm going to use the smartphone and then open the Skype on the smartphone. And my father-in-law rang me from his landline on Skype, and it didn't work. And I tried to ring him back using Skype back to his landline, and it didn't work. And I don't understand why.
Did you investigate? SIPgate or CSIP Simple or any of those?
I haven't had the chance, but probably I will now.
Yeah.
Probably I will, because I'm going to be left, thanks to Virgin Media, I'm going to be left without telephone line for, I don't know, indefinitely. So I thought Skype was basically just the obvious choice, because I already had it. I was already a subscriber of it, but it doesn't work. And I just want Skype to tell me, why doesn't it work on my smartphone when they're still taking my money
Abandon the proprietary protocols.
It really annoys me.
I use SIP at home and it works brilliantly.
Yeah, I use SIP, but it's really expensive. It's still buying the equipment, isn't it? That's the only problem.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the phones are expensive.
If you're just doing it as temporary until Virgin Media sorts out things, CSIP simple for your Android phone. And your broadband connection, or even your 3G connection on your phone, will connect you to the outside world nicely.
All right. Combined with SIP gate. We're trying that.
Give it a go.
And the other discovery was that I was listening to The Clash the other day.
Oh, yeah.
I was listening to Should I Stay and Should I Go? And half of the lyrics are in Spanish for those ones who'd never realized since the 80s. Half of the lyrics are in Spanish.
I didn't know that.
Well,
I can't have listened that closely.
But I'm going to read it what I just find out. The Spanish backing vocals are courtesy of George Strummer, who apparently was a guitarist, wasn't it? So, on the spur of the moment, I said, I'm going to do the backing vocals. In Spanish, we need a translator. So Eddie Garcia, the tape operator, called his mother in Brooklyn Heights and read her all the lyrics over the phone. And she translated them. But Eddie and his mom are Ecuadorian. So it is Ecuadorian Spanish that me and Joey Ellie, that was the singer, wasn't it? Are singing in the back, and the backing vocals. So for most people, for most people of my age who listened to the Clash back in the 80s.
62?
Yeah, 75. especially those ones who don't speak Spanish. Well, even those ones who spoke Spanish, I never realized that they were singing the song in both languages. So there you go.
Cool.
That was me.
Awesome. Thanks, Effie. Thanks, everyone.
Was that a good discovery of the week section, Graham?
I think it was mediocre.
What would you give it out of 10?
4.
Okay.
That's quite mediocre. That's quite
mediocre. With such linguistic confusion, we come to the halfway point of this podcast. Still to come, great successes in You Dare Us, Speak Your Brains, and of course, the open ballot.
Great, so time for You Dare Us.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Great success.
I feel so good for making such a positive contribution to society through this.
Yes, so we failed, in other words. Basically what happened was, it looks like creating your own mesh network is really quite simple with all our research, but you do need the right hardware, and despite my best efforts, we couldn't get a hold of the best hardware. Looked around the office, and you'd think in a publishing company who does a lot of technology magazines, you'd find some, but no. Checked with a Bristol Wireless and Bristol Hackspace people, no luck. But something good has come out of it, and I am going to go and visit the people at Bristol Wireless next week on Wednesday.
Hooray.
I'm going to write up an article for issue 152 about Bristol Wireless, what they do, how cool it is, why they do it, and how they do it. So
brilliant.
Something good came out of it in the end.
I call that a win.
Yeah. I think that is a win.
It's a win.
Yeah.
Not a fail, a win.
This is what we plan to do all along.
But and the other thing, just, you know, there's not a lot else to say about it really, but Bristol Hackspace are having an open day this weekend where you can go along and you can see, I presume, plane throwing robots and other cool electronic gizmos they've made. So look up their website and go and check it out this weekend. And
so that'll be the 18th. No.
Yeah, I
think. 17th.
Yeah, Saturday.
Saturday, 17th of September, for those of you listening in October.
And then, yeah,
you probably missed it.
In October, actually, they're having another open day with all the artists who they share their Hackspace lab with.
Oh, great.
Oh, cool.
So there's going to be all their electronic gizmos again, but also a ton of artwork and other cool things. So do check out their website and see their upcoming events, because I'm at least going to the one in October, even if I can't make this weekend. So if you're going, maybe we'll see you there.
Mm, awesome. So, okay, well, we do tend to fail You Dare Us a bit. Because
the other good thing is that we've realised that this is just rubbish, isn't it?
Yeah. We are busy making a magazine 99.9% of the time, so...
Or learning to write Scheme.
Oh, yeah, in John's case, staring at brackets. But, so, let's... Maybe we'll do some more You Dare Us's in the future if we think of something actually doable. But in the meantime, let's try a different section.
Yeah, okay.
What about one where we big up an open source project and also have a bit of a rant about another one as well, like the old one minute?
Yeah, that's a good idea, because it kind of meant that we had to stick to a certain format and it was quick.
It was quick, yeah. So
that was a bit negative, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We sort of moaned about something for a minute. But if we have to, you know, find something to praise as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm thinking, like, rants and raves or something like that. So one person has a rant for a minute about something that annoys them in Linux world, and one person has a rave about something that's really cool, like,
okay,
yeah, this feature's great. And then
it's easy to forget how much really, really epically, awesomely, in monumentally awesome stuff there is in Linux.
Yep. Mm.
So we're going to remind you.
Yes, whether you like it or not, listeners.
And if we do get a good idea for a You Dare Us,
that's
we'll
feasible.
Do it.
That doesn't
we'll
involve do hardware. Yeah.
Not too much time.
Yeah.
Doesn't rip us away.
Because I do really like the idea of it.
Just hasn't worked out for a while.
Or maybe we've done all the easy ones, so there's nothing left.
Maybe people can sponsor us to do it.
Yeah, if people want to pay
sponsor us in beer. Then,
you know, if you want to send us a selection of your local brewery's finest beer through the post with a You Dare Us attached, then we'll receive it at Future Publishing and just to the editorial team.
Yeah. Please send us beer to Linux Format. Linux Format Magazine, Future Publishing, 30 Monmouth Street, Bath, BA1, 2BW, England. If anybody sends us a beer, that would be awesome.
In fact, forget about any challenges or anything. Just send us beer.
Please send us beer. We'd really appreciate
we're
it. Really
we do thirsty. Like trying different local beers, you know.
And we'll put a photo of us drinking the beer on tuxradar.com.
Yeah, no possibly problem. On the back page of a magazine. We run out of reader desktops.
No crisps?
They tend to get damaged during transport.
What if you send us beer and crisps, we'll give the crisps to Effie and we'll drink the beer.
Yeah, you heard it here. Effie's more interested in the crisps than the beer.
Excellent. So rants and raves next month while we're drinking reader-contributed beer.
Excellent. But excellent. Don't put any poison in it, please. Now we're going to get poisoned.
Why did...
Silly me, I always made that mistake. It's time for Speak Your Brains. And we've had a couple more Speak Your Brainses sent to me this episode.
Brilliant.
And they're actually quite short and not full of XML, so people are getting really, really good at it.
People aren't trolling you anymore then.
Yeah, exactly. So, this is where you listeners have a chance to have a rant or a rave about something yourselves, and I'll read it out on air. Just email mike.saunders@futurenet.com with Speak Your Brains in the subject line, and I'll read out your musings. Let's start off with Chris, who doesn't appear to have been born with a surname. He says... I wanted to give a big thank you to the Vector Linux team. My aunt, who is hard of sight, wanted to continue to read, so I wrote a simple Python program a few months ago that allowed her to read public domain books, listen to the BBC online, listen to MP3s, and show a clock on an older laptop. I wanted to program it so that she could easily change the font size and be able to adapt it for her specific needs, since she has never really used PCs. Vector Linux was a great distro that was efficient on an older laptop with all the programming tools I needed and great stability when running the programs. Thank goodness for good old Vector Linux.
Absolutely brilliant. Well done. Yeah. That's a really good thing to do.
That's great. And it's a big up to a lesser known distro as well.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Goodness for people like Chris.
Yeah.
Doing awesome stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Despite not having a surname. Despite all those challenges in life.
Maybe you should share it or send it to us, and you know,
really
other people
cool.
in a similar situation might be able to use it.
You could put it on Hot Picks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Send us the program, Chris, if you like. Yeah. And then Joseph Van Pelt says, I love the magazine. I've been a subscriber for a while. I gave Unity a week and asked my family to test it as well. I've got them used to changes since I eradicated all Windows viruses 6 years ago. The results were great. We have all been using it since May, including my 6, 7, and 11-year-old daughters. When I showed my wife that she didn't have to remember what program was used for different tasks, she has loved it. Hit the super key and type scan, and you get a program for scanning. This works for other things like letter, write, etc. There are also keyboard shortcuts for launcher programs like Super Plus 6 opens the sixth entry in the launcher. It works for power users, and the Discover ability seems on par with other desktops.
Excellent, excellent. So obviously it's good news that Canonical have pleased some people and it's not completely lost in the wilderness in terms of usability, and that's important.
Yeah, I think the idea that, I've not thought of it in this way before, but what he was saying that you can just type scan, you can actually type in the name of the task that you want to achieve and then it will bring up the program.
Yeah,
so you don't have
yeah.
to think of Firefox or LibreOffice, you just type in letter, or, you know, I don't know how clever it is with semantics and stuff. I don't know if you can type in, you know, like make chart and it will open the spreadsheet program, but that could be really good for new users. Edit picture and it starts up the GIMP or Shotwell or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is a good idea. Mm. I don't think that should be the main interface, but it's nice that it works.
That could be good for new users. Yeah. So thanks, folks. Keep them coming. Mike.Saunders@futurenet.com with the subject line "Speak Your Brains."
Open ballots!
Hooray!
It's time for open ballots.
Which this fortnight asks the question: is Linux more secure than other operating systems just because it's Linux?
It's got an X in it.
So this is cool. This is on the back of recent hackerizations, which happened to kernel.org, linux.com, and reportedly the linuxfoundation.org websites. Hmm. All of whom we assume are running Linux. And so.
Good point.
I'd say running on Microsoft's Azure platform.
So it should, in theory, have been quite hard for them to get hacked.
Do we know anything about vulnerabilities that people exploited? I mean, I guess they were just in Apache, which isn't necessarily.
I think what has been said so far is they think the hack originated with a user whose credentials got compromised, given that there were about 400 or 500 SSH users on the system.
Oh, right. Oh, well.
And then, right. But then they did manage to escalate to root and plant rootkits and stuff.
Right. So that's a genuine Linux kind
of. There was a genuine hack there. I think, from what my crude understanding of it so far.
Yeah.
Why do they need 400 or 500 different SSH accounts on the kernel? I thought it just Torvalds would upload the tarball when
it's kernel.org, so
guess a password,
hosts
guess
a load of it. Information, you know, like wiki.kernel.org is really useful. So there's a lot of other stuff going on there that people contribute to.
I wonder how many kernel.org people have password 01 as their password.
Penguin with the
ABC123. Anyway, the first comment has to go to expat3737. Who says, I've read the posed question above and the reader's input. I must agree that some good points were raised.
Excellent.
And then says some more words, and then concludes with, yes, this incident is bad news. However, it does no good to write a headline suggesting Linux is shoddy. That kind of fodder feeds the anti-Linux crowd. Ask the question by all means, but don't infer inferior status or quality. I don't think we were doing that, were we?
I think he sounds very disturbed.
I think you. Yeah. I think you ask the or she.
Yeah.
But don't be sexist.
Or it.
I think we asked the question in order to elicit responses, not in order to have the question criticised.
If the headline was, why is Linux rubbish, he might have a point.
Exactly.
In fact, the problem is asking a question at all. I think what people like him need is just, you know, things like brown, red, green, flowers in a meadow.
What should we have done? Just say, you know, Linux is awesome and never go into the reasons why. It just is. Just accept it as if it were, you know, carved on a stone tablet.
Yeah, let's never ever have discussions about Linux.
So
again,
That's that discussion over.
I think it's very interesting that it might have happened through SSH. And I think the problem is not obviously nothing to do with Linux, but the fact it's down to maintaining a system with so many users, so many things to keep on top of, probably with all different kinds of privileges, and it's so easy to have left a floating, you know, super user bit on some bash script or something like that. Anything could have happened.
Yeah. Like a system, any system is hackable. There's never going to be a perfect piece of software.
Yeah.
So you've got to rely on layers of security to make sure it's secure. And if one of those layers gets breached through a silly mistake, then it opens up other things that it's all unravels.
Yeah.
That's true, obviously. I think one of the golden threads that runs through the comments section, which you can still see up there on tuxradar.com, is that a system is only as secure as its user, and that the person ultimately to blame for any security leaks is the user and the person who's clicked on, for example, hotbritney.exe.
Well,
and Linux users are less likely to do that. But is there anything, you know, specifically in Linux itself that makes it more secure, do we think?
I think the general engineering of it and the fact that it's open source, as we've said many times, more eyeballs looking at the code, able to find and fix bugs quicker and security holes quicker. I think it should be stressed about the type of user is important. If we switched every single user of Windows tomorrow to Ubuntu 11.04, say, within hours, there'd be emails going around the net saying critical security fix for operating system with a .deb attached. People would enter their passwords. That would, you know, turn the box into a botnet, part of a botnet immediately. So we do benefit from having a good security model in Linux, but also clever users as well.
I mean, there are some amazing technologies that were enterprise level and then made it to general consumers first, really, in Linux. Things like SE Linux and AppArmor, you know, quality firewalls being built into the kernel, file and user permissions, and all of that. All of that technology is there, available in a consumer-grade operating system, come down from the NSA and big business. It's probably Linux's most impressive security feature.
But Spangwidges says, and quite a few other reads actually have spoken out in praise of package managers. I know that they've been much maligned in the past. John says that one of the major advantages of package managers over bundles is that they provide automatic cryptographic information.
This actually was me.
Well, it was you.
This was me.
Awesome. Well, go on then.
Read it out. I won't say it as well again.
One of the major advantages of package managers over bundles is that they provide automatic cryptographic confirmation of whether or not you're actually downloading a file that your distribution has released and sanctioned. This is very long.
It's very well written.
As opposed to one.
Read Linux Format magazine, and you get this every month.
As opposed to one that some crackers managed to place into the system. Sure, you could run NB5 on a bundle and check it with a website, but it's not automatic, and so it's much less likely to be used.
Wow, was there any punctuation in that?
Repository that does have a definite yes.
I thought you were John Robb.
Not on Tax Radar.
So we've got to look back through all recent comments and look for stuff by John now, and we'll know it's you.
Yeah, I didn't comment very often, just every now and again.
Shimmy says, didn't Microsoft just Shimmy. All of a sudden involved in the Linux kernel? Interesting timing. Perhaps that way it wasn't suspicious that they were poking around kernel.org. What's this? Another Bob the Linux hacker says, because the package manager covers both OS and apps, it's more likely that all the software on a particular system will be up to date at any one time, compared with Windows, where the OS has an updater, Adobe products have a separate one, Apple products another one, and so on. A veritable Tower of Babel. And Spangwidges, as I said earlier, a bigger advantage of free software, in my eyes, is that in the proprietary world, there's a vested interest in concealing security flaws, which is not present in the free software world, where they're inherently public from the start. So that's not exactly a technical reason why Linux is more secure, but it's a cultural and societal community one.
I read an interview with Kevin Mitnick on Slashdot recently, and he gave a classic example of someone gave the example of libdvd CSS or CSS encryption for DVDs, and the fact that it was developed by a company in private, and, you know, the entertainment companies thought this is the best way to do it, and it was cracked within days. And apparently the company who developed the encryption said, you know, this is stupid, we don't want to do it, we just want to deter casual users. They said it's never going to be a secure algorithm when it's developed in private like this, so, and it got hacked very quickly.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that Linux is more secure, but it's still, you know, when you've got 400 users with SSH accounts, it's almost impossible.
What was that? Was it Linspire, the one that ran as the Linux distro that logged you in as root by default?
Yeah.
Was that?
It's weird that's just come up when I did that post about last night. I did a post about the things that I remember from the last 150 issues, and one of them was an interview with Michael Robertson where I got into an argument with Michael Robertson, who was the head of Linspire and the previous owner of mp3.com, about exactly that, running as root by default, which they did. And there's this big angry quote in there of him defending why you need to run as root or root's fine. There wasn't any logic to his argument. His argument was that, well, there's no difference between running as root and knowing the password to root and using it for every administrative task, and we just kind of cut to the chase with that.
Whatever happened to Michael Robertson?
Whatever happened? He's still semi-successful. He's because of, in fact, mp3.com became a musical locker so that you could import, upload your mp3 files for albums and access them anywhere from the internet. And that was 7 years ago.
Right.
Which, in fact, is what Amazon's cloud, mp3 cloud, and what iTunes cloud things are doing right now. So I still think he's got quite a viable business in that.
And presumably he's still massively rich.
Yeah.
From selling whatever it was he sold in the first place.
I think it was mp3.com, but he was also one of the first people. He did one of the first Where's search engines online. I can't remember which it was. Funny guy.
Did Linspire have an app store back in
the
day?
It did,
yeah.
It had a shop. Ahead of the times.
Yeah, what happened to Linspire?
Well, everyone running it got hacked, clearly. For running as root. Brilliant. Thank you, everybody. That was an awesome podcast. Yeah, sorry that there's no one more thing. But it turns out I do like doing one more things, but I am actually powered by beer. So if you really do send beer to the office, I'll be able to generate loads of one more things, at least four a bottle. So, great.
Wow, four a bottle. That's only one bottle of beer for every 2 months' work. Right,
that sucks. I mean, four bottles of beer for every one more thing. Thanks, listeners.
Any preference for beer?
Preferably Bavarian Weissbier, I would like.
Right, and you can get that in bottles?
Oh, aye. You can only get it in bottles in Bavaria, yeah. You shouldn't get that off the tap in Bayern.
Okay. Awesome. Okay. Thanks, everyone. See you in 2 weeks. Bye. Yeah.